Kia ora, this program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Wellington Access Radio, make your voice heard.
Good day, everyone, and welcome to Capital Irish, the Irish-related program that comes to you every Sunday at high noon. My name is Jim Friel, originally from County Mayo. I am one of a number of Irish presenters who help bring this show to you, the listeners, every Sunday at 12 o'clock. We are supported by our sponsors, Peter and Susie McGuinness, the Lore Hut Irish Society and the Wellington Irish Trust. With me in the studio doing the technicals is Dougie O'Sullivan, who is also one of our presenters and always does a great job in getting this show out to you wherever in the world you may be. You can also Google us and listen on wellingtonaccessradio.org.nz. The month of May is the anniversary of quite a few historical events in Irish history, some well-known and some not so well-known. One of the not so well-known was mentioned this month in the Irish Central. Charles Stuart Parnell, the leader of the Irish Parliamentary Home Rule Party, was released from Kilmainham Jail in May 1892, where he had been imprisoned for 6 months with others during the Land League Wars. He was released in what was known as the Kilmainham Treaty. Shortly after his release, the two most senior British officials in Ireland, Chief Secretary Lord Cavendish and the Under Secretary Thomas Henry Burke, were assassinated in the Phoenix Park by a group known as the Invincibles. The assassins were rounded up by the Dublin Metropolitan Police and in due course hanged. The authorities and Dublin Castle tried to associate Parnell with the Invincibles, that's the nationalist group. A few years after this happened, at the height of Parnell's powers and Home Rule gaining huge traction, the pro-government mouthpiece, the London Times, published a fake newsletter, which they had paid the equivalent of more than $200,000 in today's currency, which bore Parnell's signature, saying that he condoned the assassinations. Parnell condemned the letter as a forgery, but there was a concentrated campaign to force him to resign. Eventually, the authorities were forced to appoint a panel of three judges to investigate the charges made by the Times. Parnell suspected that the forger was a man called Richard Pigott, once a supporter of his, but now working as a spy for the Crown. But he had to prove it before the three judges. Pigott, of course, naturally denied everything. Parnell hired a County Down top lawyer by the name of Charles Russell, to defend himself. And on the witness stand, Russell was cross-examining Pigott and casually asked Pigott to write down a few words. One of the words was hesitant, which Pigott incorrectly spelled with an E, the very same as was in the fake letter. Under cross-examination, he broke down on the stand. His fake letter and treachery were exposed, and Parnell was exonerated. Pigott went away and committed suicide shortly after that. So you see, fake news was not invented by Donald Trump. The London Times were practicing it in the 1890s. But soon, the enemies of Ireland found a new weapon to destroy Parnell, the so-called uncrowned King of Ireland. And that weapon was Kitty O'Shea's husband, Captain O'Shea. Now, he and Kitty had been separated for 5 years before she and Parnell got together, and she went on to have 3 children with Parnell. Their relationship was well known in the important circles, but in 1890, 15 years after his separation from Kitty, our brave captain decided to sue for divorce, naming Parnell as correspondent. Well, because of the hypocrisy and the Victorian morality of the time, when it became public that Parnell and Kitty O'Shea were living together as a non-married couple, all hell broke loose. Both the Catholic and Church of England bishops condemned them from their pulpits. His own party, Parnell's party, split on the issue, and the great uncrowned king was forced to resign as leader. Some historians say that Captain O'Shea was bribed to sue for divorce in order to destroy Parnell's influence, as he was its main driving force, that is, home rule. Winston Churchill was an admirer of Parnell, and he probably summed it up better than most when he wrote, "Parnell dedicated his life to the goal of Ireland, an independent nation, and he pursued that goal unswervingly until he met Kitty, who opened up a new world for him, the world of love. And just as he had sacrificed all for Ireland, when the moment of choice came, Parnell sacrificed all, even Ireland, for love." Such is the tale of a Greek tragedy, the Parnell-Kitty O'Shea love affair, condemned Ireland to a melancholy fate, and the British Empire to a woeful curtailment of its harmony and strength. There is some truth in that. Churchill certainly had a way with words. Parnell legally married Kitty after the divorce, but the tragedy was that he died 4 months later from pneumonia in the arms of Kitty, his great love. Parnell was 45 years old. After his death, Kitty returned to her birthplace in England. She was from a wealthy, aristocratic English family. She never remarried and died in 1921 at the age of 75. There you are. The month of May is also the anniversary of the 1916 Rising, which, of course, is much better known and was a direct result, really, of home rule not being granted in Parnell's time. And of course, May is also the month of the cold-blooded executions, also in Kilmainham Jail, of 13 of the leaders. There was 3 more executed afterwards. But most of them, these are the rebels, were young poets and visionaries, people who could see the harvest when the snow was on the ground. 2 of the young poets executed were Thomas Macdonagh and Joseph Plunkett. Thomas was married to Muriel Gifford, and Joseph would marry her sister Grace in Kilmainham Jail Chapel a few hours before he was taken out and shot in the yard. The 2 young men, of course, were signatories to the 1916 proclamation. Tragically, Thomas Macdonagh's wife Muriel died in a drowning accident 1 year later in 1917. I will now play the song Grace, sung here by an 11-year-old young woman, Kiva Mooney.
Think about these past few weeks, or where they say we've failed. From our school days, they have told us we must yearn for liberty. Yet all I want in this dark place is to have you here with me. Oh, grace, just hold me in your arms and let this moment linger. They'll take me out at dawn and I will die. With all my love, I'll place this wedding ring upon your finger. There won't be time to share our love, for we must say goodbye. Now I know it's hard for you, my love, to ever understand the love I share for these brave men, the love for this dear land. But when Rory called me to his side down in the GPU, I had my own sick bed, to him I had to go. Oh, grace, just hold me in your arms and let this moment linger. They'll take me out at dawn and I will die. With all my love, I'll place this wedding ring upon your finger. There won't be time to share our love, for we must say goodbye. Now as the dawn is breaking, my heart is breaking too. Will be of you, and I'll write some words upon the wall so everyone will know. I loved so much that I could see his blood upon the road. Oh, grace, just hold me in your arms and let this moment.
Hope you enjoy that. There has a book been written recently called Unlikely Rebels, and it's about the Gifford sisters. There were six Gifford sisters in a family of 12 in Rathmines, Dublin. Their mother was Protestant and the father was a Catholic and a Dublin solicitor. They were a reasonably well-off family for the times. The book is written by Anne Clare. I have not read it, but it has had some very good reviews. Grace, incidentally, died in 1955 and once again never remarried. I am reading some whodunit books, crime books, on my Kindle that are actually set in Dublin in the Parnell years. The crime books are written by Dublin writer Conor Brady, and it's about the Dublin Metropolitan Police. The hero in the crime books is a detective sergeant called Joe Swallow, who, with others, is very, very good at solving murder cases. He gets around the city on steam trams and horse-drawn traps and sidecars. It's also got the politics of the time in the background. These crime books are very, very good and easy to read. And anybody that's interested, they give a great insight into the Ireland of that time. That's the 1880s. The Land League movement, Dublin Castle, etc., the things I've spoken about, and the Phoenix Park, assassinations. Now, Irish musician and songwriter Eugene Cunningham has recently composed a new song called The Unseen Irishman. I read about it recently in the Irish Central. Cunningham is from County Fermanagh, and he plays lead guitar in various Irish country bands and has travelled extensively around Ireland and England. One of his regular destinations was London. He enjoyed walking around and speaking to Irish immigrants in little cafes. Often he would see an old Irishman on his own, eating and drinking tea in total silence. Sometimes he would approach them, and when they realised that he was Irish and just over playing music, they would smile and ask questions about home and music and dancing and that sort of thing. Oh, and did you ever play at such a place? For a while, he says, they would come alive and ask, what's it like over in Ireland now? They were lonely men, living alone far from Ireland. They had left in the 1950s and worked on rebuilding war-torn cities around England and new motorways. And after sending back money to their parents to help raise younger siblings, not many returned, even for a visit to Ireland. And now old and living alone in one-bedroom flats and sometimes boarding houses, Cunningham often thought about them, and he wrote this song to their memory. I will now play it, The Unseen Irishman.
In a cafe, you'll find him in silent solitude. In Camden Town or Kilburn, Holloway or Cricklewood, he's well into his 70s. He's given all he can. The world has no more use now for the unseen Irishman. On building sites in heat and cold, they worked him to the ground, then dropped him off in bars they owned, took back his car there and pound. From there back to a sad bed's it, next morning to the van. That's how the life was taken from the unseen Irishman. He never met a woman, never gave himself a chance. The cronies and the drink came before a social or a dance. So a bedsit in North London with a 20 square foot span became the sole existence of the unseen Irishman. He could couldn't seem to save enough to go home on holiday. He carried shame, he wasn't there as the old folk passed away. His homeland changed and moved with times. He's now an extinct clan. Nobody has the time there now for the unseen Irishman. Now this is just a small part of a story I could tell. Most of the men who took the boat made it, and some damn well. Just spare a thought for the lonely soul who never had a plan and ended up in nowhere land, the unseen Irishman.
An interesting documentary aired on Irish television recently. It was called The Burren Heart of Stone and suggested that early inhabitants of Ireland were in fact black and had blue eyes. In the documentary, forensic scientists have found evidence that black people lived in Ireland about 10,000 years ago and lived around the coast, living on shellfish, hazelnuts and wild boar, and slept in caves. Then about 4 or 5,000 years ago, they were replaced by farmers who eventually established the modern gene pool as we know it today. This evidence follows on from the discovery of the Natural History Museum in London that the Cheddar Man, an ancient skeleton found in a cave in southwest England in 1903, had dark to black skin with blue eyes. Dr. Dan Bradley, a professor of genetics at Trinity College Dublin, said the current light skin that we have in today's Ireland is at the end point of thousands of years of surviving in a climate where there's little sun. We have adapted to the need for vitamin D in the skin over thousands of years. He says it's likely that every Irish person is descended from those past individuals one way or another. Well, who knows? There may be some truth in it. They say we humans don't understand 90% of what's in the universe. Another interesting snippet I read recently in the Irish Post was about the legend of the cladder ring. How many of us wear cladder rings? How many of us know what it signifies? This article says it goes back to at least the year 1700, during the reign of Mary II in Britain. A young Galway man, Richard Joyce, was kidnapped by Mediterranean pirates when out at sea. He was sold by the pirates to a wealthy goldsmith who, over many years of captivity, taught Joyce the skills of his trade, with Joyce becoming an excellent craftsman. The goldsmith became very fond of Joyce, and despite offering him a hefty financial package and his daughter's hand in marriage, Joyce opted to go back to his native Cladder. Here he was met by the love of his life, who had waited all those years to lay eyes on him again. So Joyce crafted the Cladder ring, made up of interlocking hands to represent friendship, a crown to show their loyalty, and a heart to symbolise their love. That symbol would be associated with Cladder for centuries to come. The Cladder is a fishing village in Galway and was a thriving village in the old days. The famous Galway hooker boats are still associated with the Cladder. The Cladder people had their own distinct culture right up to the 1930s. But the great TB outbreak in 1927 had a devastating effect on the cladder that would see the village being consumed into Galway City. Under fierce protest, the last of the cladder people were moved out of their thatched cottages one by one and relocated when their homes were deemed a health hazard. The last cottage was demolished in 1934, and since then the local authorities have rebuilt the village into what is now a residential suburb of Galway City, just across the river from the Spanish Arch. The unique community may have been swallowed by Galway City, but its legacy is still strong. The cladder ring is worn by women and men of Irish heritage right across the world as a symbol of love, friendship and loyalty, and is one of the most recognisable Irish images. Well, time has run out. Make sure you listen every week to Capital Irish. There's a variety of Irish presenters from different counties on the island of Ireland and from different age groups. If you like a show or think your family or friends might like it, send them the link on wellingtonaccessradio.org.nz. Fare thee well until next time. We'll go out with the Cladder Ring, sung here by Dermot O'Brien.
My grandmother's, she wore it a lifetime and gave it to me all through the long years. She wore it so proudly, it was made when a cladder rolls down to the sea. What tales it could tell of trials and of hardships and of grand happy days when the whole world could sing. So away with your sorrow, it will bring love tomorrow. Sure everyone loves it, the old cladder ring. With the crown and the crest to remind us of honour and clasping of a heart that God's blessing would bring. The circle of gold always kept homes contented with true love entwined in the old cladder ring. As she knelt at her prayers and thought of her dear ones, her soft gentle smile, it would charm a king.
You've been listening to Capital Irish on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. Thanks to the generosity of our sponsors, we couldn't be here without them. Our sponsors are Wellington Irish Trust, Susie and Peter McGuinness, Hutt Valley Irish Society and Butler's Chocolates. A very big thank you from all of us on the Capital Irish team.
That programme was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.